52. My boyfriend's back. Chevette had had a boyfriend named Lowell when she'd first lived on the bridge, who did dancer. Lowell had had a friend called Codes, called that because he tumbled the codes on hot phones and notebooks, and this St. Vitus reminded her of Codes. Codes hadn't liked her either. Chevette hated dancer. She hated being around people when they were on it, because it made them selfish, too pleased with themselves, and nervous, suspicious, too prone to make things up in their heads, imagining everyone out to get them, everyone lying, everyone talking behind their back. And she particularly hated watching anyone actually do the stuff, rub it into their gums the way they did, all horrible, because it was just so gross. Made their lips numb at first, so they'd drool a little, and how they always thought that was funny. But what she hated about it most was that she'd ever done it herself, and that even though she had all these reasons to hate it, she still found herself watching St. Vitus vigorously massaging a good solid hit into his gums, feeling the urge to ask him for some. She guessed that was what they meant by it being addictive, that she'd gotten just that little edge of it off the country singer sticking his tongue in her mouth, and if that was the only way to get it, she thought, she'd pass. And now the actual molecules of Diz were twanging at receptor sites in her brain, saying, "Gimme, gimme." And she'd never even been properly strung out on the stuff, not how they meant it when they said that on the street. Carson had coordinated on a Reel One sequence about the history of stimulants, so Chevette knew the dancer was somewhere out there past crack cocaine in terms of sheer gotcha. The addiction schedule was a little less merciless in terms of frequency, but she'd figured she'd still just barely missed it, chipping with Lowell. Lowell, who'd explained in detail and at great length how the schedule he'd worked out for using it was going to optimize his functionality in the world, but never result in one of those ugly habit deals. You just had to know how to do it, and when to do it, and most important of all, why to do it. Powerful substance like this, Lowell would explain, it wasn't there for just any casual jack-off recreational urge. It was there to allow you to do things, to empower you, he said, so that you could do things and, best of all, finish them. Except that what Lowell had mainly wanted to do, Dizzed, was have sex, and the Diz made it impossible for him to finish, which had been okay by Chevette, because otherwise he tended to finish a little on the quick side. The Reel One sequence had said the dancer made it possible for men to experience something much more like the female orgasm, a sort of ongoing climax, less localized and, well, messy. Dancer was pretty deadly stuff in terms of getting people into bed in the first place. Strangers doing dancer together, if there was any basis for attraction at all, were inclined to decide that that was basically a fine idea, and one to be acted on right away, but only provided the other party seemed agreeable to doing it until both were pretty well dead. And people did wind up dead around the stuff. Hearts stopped, lungs forgot to breathe, crucial tiny territories of brain blew out. People murdered one another when they were crazy on the stuff, and then in cold blood just to get some more. It was one ugly substance and no doubt about it. "You got any more of that?" she asked St. Vitus, who was dabbing at the spit-slick corners of his mouth with a wadded-up tissue, dots of blood dried brown on it. St. Vitus fixed her with his slitty glasses. "You gotta be kidding," he said. "Yeah," said Chevette, pushing off the stool. "I am." It must have been the time of night. How could she even have thought that? She could smell his metallic breath in the sound box. "Got it," said Tessa, pulling off the glasses. "Crowd's thinning. Chevette, I need you to help me get the camera platforms together." St. Vitus smirked. At the thought, Chevette guessed of somebody else having to do something like work. "You haven't seen Carson, have you?" Chevette asked, stepping to the window. The dwindling crowd, seen from above, was moving in one of those ways that there was probably a logarithm for, milling and dispersing. "Carson?" She spotted Buell Creedmore just in front of the stage, talking with a big guy in a black jacket, his back to the sound booth. Then the big guitar player, the one with a squashed cowboy hat, jumped down from the stage and seemed to be giving Creedmore a hard time. Creedmore tried to say something, got shut up, then managed to say something short, and by the look on his face not too sweet, and the guitar player turned and walked away. Chevette saw Creedmore say something to the other guy, gesturing back in her direction, and this one turned and headed that way, his face concealed, from just this angle, by a dusty swoop of black-painted cable. "He was here before," Chevette said. "That's why I Frenched the mesh back and ran out the door. Didn't you wonder?" Tessa looked at her.
"I did, actually, but I thought maybe I was just getting to know you better." She laughed. "Are you sure it was him?"
"It was him, Tessa."
"How would he know we're up here?"
"Somebody told him at the house. You talked enough before about your docu."
"Maybe," Tessa said, interest waning. "Help me get the platforms tethered, okay?"
She handed Chevette 4 black nylon tethers, each one tipped with a mini bungee and a metal clip.
"Listen," Chevette said, "I'm not up for a night at Cognitive Dissonance, okay?"
"I don't think you are either. I just watched your friend here gum enough dancer to wire a mule."
"Chevette," Tessa said, "we're up here to document, remember? We're going interstitial."
St. Vitus sniggered. "I think where we're going is to sleep, Tessa."
"Where's the truck?" "Where we packed it."
"How'd you get the balloons back here?"
"Elmar," Tessa said, "has one of those caps and an ATV to go with it."
"See if you can find him again," Chevette said, starting down the ladder. "We could use a lift back." Chevette wasn't sure what it would actually take to get Tessa to give up on Cognitive Dissonance. Worst case, she might actually have to go there, if only to make sure Tessa was okay. Cogdis was a rough enough place, even if you didn't have your head buried in a pair of video glasses. She went down the ladder and headed out onto the floor, where God's little toy was already descending under Tessa's control. She reached up, got it tethered, and turned back to signal Tessa, in the sound booth, to start bringing the others down. And found herself looking, for however many dreamlike seconds before he hit her, into Carson's eyes. Hard and in the face, just like he'd done before, and she saw those same colors like a flashback, saw herself falling back across the big beige couch in this loft space, blood splashing from her nose, and still not believing it, that he'd done that. Except that here she went over into a couple of Creedmore's remaining audience, who caught her, laughing, saying, "Hey, whoa!" And then Carson was on her again, grabbing a handful of Skinner's jacket. "Hey, buddy," said one of the men who'd caught her, holding up his spread hand as if to block the second punch that Carson, his face as calm and serious as she'd seen it in the editing booth at Reel One, was aiming at her. And looking into Carson's eyes, she saw nothing there like hatred or anger, only some abstract and somehow almost technical need. Carson tried for her, past that stranger's upraised hand, and her protector yelped as one of his fingers got bent back. It deflected the blow, though, and gave Chevette time to twist out of that grip. She backed off 2 steps and shook her head, trying to clear it. Something was wrong with her eyes. Carson came after her, that same look on his face, and in that instant she knew that she knew neither who he was nor what it was that was wrong with him.
"You just didn't get it, did you?" he said.
Or that was what she thought she heard him say, feeling a tear run down from her swelling eye, her head still ringing. She took a step back. He came on.
"You just didn't get it."
And then a hand came down on his shoulder, and he spun around and went down, the man behind him having done something that Chevette hadn't seen. And she saw that it was Rydell.
It wasn't.
It was. Rydell, in a rent-a-cop's black nylon jacket, looking at her with an expression of utter and baffled amazement. And Chevette got it right then, and absolutely, that she was dreaming, and felt the most enormous sense of relief, because now she would wake up, surely, into a world that would make sense. On the floor, Carson, rolling over, got to his knees, stood up, shook himself, brushed a squashed cigarette filter from the sleeve of his jacket and sucker-punched Rydell, who saw it coming and tried to move aside, so that Carson's fist slammed into his ribs rather than his stomach as intended. And Rydell screamed in shrill animal pain, doubled over. And that was when the guy with the black leather car coat, the fresh-looking black buzz cut, black scarf knotted up high around his neck, this guy Chevette had never seen before, stepped up to Carson.
"Mistake," she thought she heard him say.
He took something from the pocket of his black coat.
Then, "You're not on the menu."
And he shot Carson right up close without looking down at the gun in his hand. And it was not a loud sound, not loud at all, more like the sound of a large pneumatic nail gun, but it was final and definitive and accompanied by a yellow-blue flash, and Chevette could never remember exactly seeing this, though she knew she had. Carson, blown back by however many thousand foot-pounds of energy, trying to find their way to kinetic rest at just that one instant in his body. But it didn't take. In memory, it did not stick, and she would be grateful. And grateful, too, though for other reasons, that this was when Tessa, in the sound booth overhead, killed the lights.